sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Amazon flies and the rest of the NASDAQ favorites die. The yen has the best week in years. Markets drop for the week as confusion reigns by central banks providing confusing commentary. And our guest today, Kathy Fetke of the Real Wealth Network. All this and much more on episode number 461 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, welcome to May. Here we are in May 2016. And this is the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Andrew Horowitz here, your host, hopefully providing you some information. We come together, as we know, each and every week to talk about things that are important regarding markets, some ideas that may be useful for you as an investor, maybe some lessons that we could all learn from the past and looking forward to what to expect in the future. We're going to have a great guest today. Kathy Fetke is an expert on the area of real estate. And I spoke to her actually before the show to discuss some of the ideas that we were going to kind of go through. And I think there's going to be a really interesting change of pace in terms of not just talking about markets with a guest, their outlook, maybe some stock picks, but kind of really focusing in on the real estate market, both commercial and residential. So I'm interested in getting to that shortly. We'll have that coming up soon. Let's talk about some of the things that did, in fact, happen over the last week and get you updated to what's going to be going on next week, because there is a whole host of things. Don't forget that at the end of the week, yep, it's that time again. We have the official employment numbers coming out. But first, let's kind of go and take a look backwards at what went on. In terms of economics, personal income rose at about 0.4% in March. Yet, according to the Commerce Department, personal spending was up only about 0.1%, which is consistent with what we've seen in that people are making a little bit more money but not spending it. Whether or not they're pulling back because of the fact that they have concern or whether it's just that they don't need anything right now, they kind of bulked up and stored up and bought up, well, maybe that's the case. But we do know that that also played out in two other areas. First, we're talking about GDP. GDP came out and the first quarter was estimated to be, at the first look, at a 0.5% quarterly rate, which is 2% on an annualized rate basis. But, you know, it's kind of the same old, right? Just kind of chugging along, a little bit of growth, not too terrible, not good, gives the central bank plenty of leeway to do all sorts of things here in the U.S., but at the same time, maybe consistent with the fact that people are not spending money is the fact that the Conference Board's Consumer Confidence Index dropped almost two points in April to the level of 94.2. And University of Michigan, which came out at the end of last week, their confidence index for consumers finished up at 89, where that was down because in March it was 91. Now, new home sales fell about 1.5% in March, and that was another drop after we saw about a 0.4 drop in February. And the interesting thing is that while there's not a lot more houses being bought, we're still seeing that the consumers are purchasing homes and paying more for them, as we see the Case-Shiller Home Price Index rose about 5.4%. So that's not bad. That's on a 12-month basis. Down a little bit, we saw that in January, they were up about 5.7% year over year. So again, it's not a big deal, not a big change. And we're not looking at that as something like, oh my gosh, look at that. That's terrible. But there's only so much we could see on an annualized basis, an increase in the value of homes being bought. So, oh well. Now for the week, the NASDAQ was the worst hit, as we have been seeing that many of the big names, excluding Amazon, which had a fantastic report, stock was up almost 10%, just blew it out in terms of their AWS component. Now remember something, Amazon gives you very wide range of earnings estimates, right? Their guidance is just enormous in terms of the spread between the top and the bottom, what they think they're going to do in terms of revenue, in terms of earnings. And if they build a little bit more, build a little bit less, put a little bit more into any kind of creation of additional infrastructure or maybe a build out, that could change the overall very drastically on a quarterly basis. But they did very well. On the other hand, we saw that Microsoft, Google, Apple, all being hit pretty hard. And the list goes on in terms of some of those larger names that are very concerning in terms of the ones that lead the market traditionally because of their just their size. The incredible size of these names are just, you know, they're market moving. Now, Facebook also did very well. So while we had kind of the old guard having some trouble, we saw that Facebook managed to obviously take advertisers' monies and convert that into extraordinarily good overall earnings. And one of the only concerning things, if there is something to be said, is that they had a much better tax rate, dropped about 5% or 6%, I think it was. And that obviously helped their earnings as well. But nonetheless, it was a good report by Facebook. And I think Facebook clipped an all-time high somewhere after their earnings announcement. But nonetheless, there was a negative week overall. The NASDAQ fell about 2.7%. The S&P and the Dow also were down for the week. The S&P lost about 1.26, and the Dow down about 1.28% for the week, but the S&P managed to have a positive month for the month of April, just slightly positive. Now, what's coming up this week? Because we have a lot of things that are on the table. Not only do we have just a barrage of earnings that are going to be coming out, but we have a lot of economics as well. So Monday, we're going to start out with the ISM Manufacturing Index, and then we have some interesting earnings coming out, and Darko Petroleum. We have Ferrari, Fossil. I'd like to see what's going on with Fossil because they've been all over the map. If you look at their chart, it's been, I think the newer trend toward not wearing watches and, you know, watches as jewelry and utilizing your smartphone or maybe even a smartwatch to replace that has really hurt them pretty significantly. On Tuesday, we're going to see Archer Daniels Midland coming out, Avis Budget. Now, remember something. We've seen that Hertz and Avis have been really, really seeing a tremendous pain trade here on the heels of the fact that many people are giving up the idea of renting cars and just going through Uber or other ride-sharing types of programs. And that has really, really trashed these stocks. If you take a look at the charts on any of these, they're just like abysmal looking. But we also have coming out on Tuesday, CBS, Clorox, Cummings. You're going to have Estee Lauder, Etsy, which we'll watch that. Grubhub is going to be interesting to watch as we're seeing other companies like Uber and even Amazon, I think, has now a food delivery option. So you have competition just in the sector itself, plus some others are getting in on the action as well. We'll have to watch Grubhub. Now, Hyatt's going to be coming out with earnings, and I'd like to watch if there's any kind of weakness there. And the same discussion we're having with Hertz and with the car rental companies is I wonder if there's going to be any kind of weakness showing in the hotels due to the fact that we have things like Airbnb and HomeAway, et cetera. If you remember, I mentioned that I was pretty positive on the HomeAway numbers that will be coming out for a lot of reasons. I talked about this on Frank Curzio's show when I was on about a week ago or so. And HomeAway was recently purchased by Expedia. And if you look at Expedia, they had just a total blowout of the numbers. Really good. The stock was up about 12% after the earnings came out on Thursday. And this is, we have to question if there's going to be any kind of after effects that are being felt by some of the more traditional companies with some of the newer ways in which to save money and to book properties. So we have, you know, kind of, if you think about this new generation of shoppers that are doing things more online through apps, etc., have really destroyed the car rental business, have taken a piece out of the traditional mall shopping and the brick and mortar. And we've seen what happens with the Dillard's and with JCPenney and Sears and Macy's and all those names, right? You have to wonder if there's going to be some kind of an effect that is being felt by the hotels because we have all these other options that are available, like, again, HomeAway, VRBO, Airbnb, et cetera. So we're going to be looking at that with Hyatt, as well as Starwood Hotels will be coming out as well that day. Wednesday, we're going to see the April ISM services, which is the bigger part of the total, right? We look at the manufacturing, which is about approximately 30% of our overall economy and about 70% of services. So we're going to look for how that's going to play out on Wednesday as well. We're also going to have the ADP's April job numbers coming out and earnings from Allstate and Fitbit, GoDaddy, Green Dot, Humana, which recently has been pulling out of some of the states in terms of the Obamacare. Let's see what else we got here. Noble Energy, Priceline. There was a big shakeup recently with Priceline. We'll see how that affects their bottom line, if at all. Tesla is going to be coming out as well. Time Warner, TripAdvisor, Whole Foods, Thursday. Initial claims leading up to the jobs numbers. So we're going to have on Wednesday the ADP numbers, Thursday the initial claims, which last week I think was the lowest since 1973. Pretty impressive in terms of what's going on with the hiring situation here. But we're also going to see that we're going to have earnings from Activision Blizzard, Alibaba, Pollo Loco, Icon Enterprises, GoPro. GoPro is going to be interesting. I remember how they pretty much just absolutely were obliterated after their last earnings report. Recent reports have said that the company has some of the highest inventory levels they've ever had. Not a very old company, but nonetheless, obviously not a lot of people are buying the products, and that really shot the stock down pretty hard after that report came out. Merck is also going to be coming out, as well as NVIDIA, Occidental Petroleum, MGM Resorts. Let's see what else here. And Yelp. And then on Friday, we get the jobs report. We're looking for about a 5% unemployment rate, probably about upwards of 200,000 new ads on there. And we're going to see earnings from Cigna, Revlon, Allergan, and Weyerhaeuser. So that's a bit of a interesting setup there. We'll see what's happening both in the industrials. We'll see the insurance area. We'll see the healthcare area. You know, there's been a lot going on. Last week was a big week for M&A. We saw that was all over the place. And some other names are popping up as, I mean, did you see this report in the Washington Post that Apple was potentially looking to buy Tesla? Now, I don't know if this is one of these old stories. I mean, years ago stories. It's cropping up again. This was something we heard some time ago, years and years and years ago, and they declined to actually do it at the time. But all of a sudden, this Washington Post article comes out saying that Apple is looking to once again purchase Tesla. Didn't do much for the stock. I think it was just a Hail Mary as Apple was starting to trend lower. The markets were getting smushed on the Icon news. I believe that was on Thursday, where midday Icon said he's out of Apple entirely at this point, and he is really worried, as he has said many times before, about markets, about the dividends and the buyback plans that are going on, the financial engineering that's happening, what's happening with oil, what's happening with the debt instruments of many of these oil-related companies, high yield implosion happening, bond yields that can't be sustainable at these levels, central banks that are problems, you know, all the things that Carl Icahn has been talking about. And you wouldn't have expected that this was going to be such a incredible market moving event. But on the heels of his discussion, Apple started dropping and markets followed. I mean, I think it was flat on the day, went down about 1%, finished about 0.8 or 0.9% down on the S&P 500. And then followed through again on Friday. Although there's a lot of recapture of some of this on Friday, there was, I think markets were down close to about 70 basis points or 90 basis points at one point during the day on Friday. And then towards the last half hour or so, just ramped higher into still closing in the red, but down only about 0.5%. Probably a lot of that was the short covering that went on through the end of the month, the fact that oil was sustaining its price weekend covering into a new month, and who knows what's going to happen with China and with the numbers, or the concern was what was going to happen with China and their numbers, and Japan. We'll talk a little bit about China and Japan after we finish up with our guests, because there's some things that we really have to talk about, because this move by the yen last week after the central bank chair, Kuroda, who everybody had expected to throw the kitchen sink in on into some kind of a stimulus plan in his conversation on Thursday, this is Japan's time on Thursday, where we saw one of the weakest CPIs that we've seen in a very long time. Inflation is just non-existent, and that was adding fuel to the fire that, man, he's going to come in with maybe more negative rates, further stimulus, just incredible amount of stimulating programs that eclipsed even what he did before, more quantitative easing, et cetera. And then he said, we're not going to do anything. And the yen just took off. The yen was up, I think, 3.5% against the U.S. dollar for the week. And the Japanese markets just fell out of bed. But for now, let's get to a discussion on real estate, because I'm pretty interested in what's happening around the country from the eyes of an expert in the area of real estate. And I think it's going to shed some interesting light on a few different issues that are currently going on. And our guest today is Kathy Fetke. She's with the Real Wealth Network, and she's founder of that and based in California. And basically, the organization is dedicated to helping members get the most current and cutting-edge education and information they need to succeed as real estate investors. So we're going to be talking about real estate today. And Kathy's a licensed realtor, been a mortgage broker, and very active in the real estate market. And also, it's pretty impressive, one of the 100 most intriguing entrepreneurs voted on by Goldman Sachs at the first annual, now second annual Builders and Innovators Summit. So, ooh, Kathy, that's pretty impressive.
Thank you. I was a little bit shocked. I received a signed letter from Lloyd Blankfein, the CEO, so I thought I'd better open this and see what.
Yeah, exactly. What do I owe? What did I do? You know? So I want to talk to you about real estate, because real estate has been something that has been the underpinning of both the good and the bad. A lot of our economy, due to just the very nature of real estate, right? There's so many different areas that feed into that, from building to the realty itself, the valuation of the investment, living there. We have to live somewhere. We have to have a roof over our heads. And there's a lot of things that are happening, and I think as we were talking earlier a little bit before we got on about some of the mixed messages that are going on, I wanted to focus in on the area of Silicon Valley first. So over the last number of years, we've clearly seen that there has been a dramatic, increase and a price increase and escalation in certain areas around the country. And a lot of that has to do with just the gobs and gobs of money that are being made in technology, right?
Yeah, well, basically, markets cycle, they ebb and flow. That's just how humans work. You know, yep. Everybody gets excited about something, and investors are looking for a place to put their money, and high tech is it. So, for the past several years, since the last recession, money has just poured into the Silicon Valley. But a lot of that is changing. And that's what people aren't quite aware of. Too often, investors don't hear when change is happening, and they're kind of using old advice or old information that is no longer useful.
So what is the big difference? I mean, what is happening? We see that clearly there has been, is it that there is facilities moving? Is it that there's layoffs happening? Because the layoffs, listen, the job market looks, as healthy as can be from where we stand on a statistical basis, from the quote unquote official numbers from the various sources of the government. I mean, what's happening that's changing?
Well, again, when you look at those employment numbers, they're a little skewed. We're hearing 5% unemployment, but a lot of that is part-time jobs. So it's almost like counting twice, because they're half jobs.
Right.
Yeah. And a lot of them, most of the job growth has been, believe it or not, with women 55 and up. So it just kind of tells you that it's empty nesters, kids are off to college, and baby boomers are going, oh, wow, we got to retire. Looks like wifey's got to go to work. And she's willing to earn a little less because maybe she hasn't been working. She's been raising the kids. So even though the employment numbers look good, when you look closer, it's not so impressive. But when you look at the what's happening in the Silicon Valley, basically, I'm born and raised there. So, I think I sat in the same cafes as Steve Jobs, you know. Mm-hmm. I wish I'd met him.
Yep.
But basically, you know, there was no place really to invest except high tech. That was really, that's the future. And so money was just pouring in to any millennial who had any kind of idea that might be the next Facebook. But unfortunately, 60% of the IPOs are trading for less than their IPO price. So it didn't work. And for obvious reasons, you know, these venture capitalists were evaluating companies that have never made a profit, not once, and valuating them at $6, $7, $8 billion. Like, how do you do that?
Right.
And so because the results haven't been there, Square is a perfect example of an IPO that happened last fall. Everyone was watching to see how it did. It traded for billions less than it had been valued and just kept dropping after that. As a result, it's the same CEO of Twitter. Twitter's been struggling too, laying off about 8% of staff. There's a lot of layoffs happening now because venture capital is pulling out, realizing they're just not getting the returns they thought they would.
But is there a massive amount of employees at technology? I mean, some of them, obviously. I mean, some of the companies have a tremendous amount. But some of the companies, I mean, you know, we're not dealing with a big employment base, right?
Well, I mean, the Silicon Valley is that's their tech jobs. You know, there's the, I don't have the stats in front of me of the percentage. But, you know, if high tech slows down, the San Francisco Bay Area is going to feel it. And the history is there to prove it. Back in 2000, here's just a little kind of example. Back in 2000, of course, we remember that as right before the bubble bust for high tech. $17 million was the average VC deal, venture capital deal, which was a 243% increase over just a few years. And at the same time, apartments and rents in San Francisco increased by 52% to 60%. 4 years later, venture capital plunged because it wasn't working to $7 million, a 50% decline. And guess what? Real estate values went down, you know, 30% to 40%. So it's very directly related. And here we are, you know, fast forward 16 years in 2010. Just 6 years ago, $6.9 million was the average VC deal. 5 years later, it was the same exact increase as the dot-com bomb, 240% increase in venture capital, up to $23 million was the average VC deal. And rents went up, prices went up the same. It's all almost like identical mirror to the 2000s.
So what's happening the most recently with the VC deals?
They're pulling out.
Really?
So
the whole thing, you probably know John C. Dvorak. He and I have a show. We do Tuesday nights. He writes for PC Magazine. He's an old timer in the whole tech area. We talked about probably 6 weeks ago or something, the whole renaming of unicorns to unicorpses.
That's the first time I've heard that. That's hilarious.
So,
it's not funny, but it's true.
No, it's not funny at all. It's pretty sad. But this whole idea of what, you know, it's what's interesting is, first of all, that we need to have a name we put on something. There's always a name. You know, you can't just, you know, you have to have names for generations. We have to have names for, things that happen in terms of, for a quick explanation and all that. You know, it's kind of like everything has to have a little icon or a little, you know, something that's a sticker name so we can quickly understand it. But the whole idea of this unicorn thing, which, to be honest with you, if you think about it and you just stop for a moment and consider what is that, which is pretty much a high-flying, mystical creature that no one really ever sees, and it's just an idea that never does anything. It's a happy idea. It's beautiful. It's really cool, but it just never really, you know, it's the opposite of a Loch Ness monster.
It's just not real.
Right.
I mean, that's, right. You know, so the reason they started calling these billion-dollar startups unicorns is because they were rare. But, you know, there were a handful of them a couple of years ago. But this past year, there was like 240 unicorns. That's no longer rare.
Right.
You know, $1 billion startup that's showing no profit. Come on.
Yeah.
You know, there's no fundamentals left.
Yeah. Where have I heard this before? Where, why have we not learned our lesson? So here's the thing. Now, if let's just say that VC is pulling out a little bit, venture capital is kind of saying, you know what? Hey, wait a minute. First of all, the valuations are way out of control, and You know, even though money's cheap and even though they can get their hands on it and there's a great idea and there will be some in there, instead of taking the shotgun approach to taking more of the kind of refined, rifle approach to find those companies that are possibly going to be the next, you know, pick your name. What happens to those that already have their money? These, you know, the venture capitalists put their money in. The various employees made all sorts of money. They bought their houses and all that. Okay, now they may be laid off. Maybe they'll go somewhere else. Maybe they won't have a job. Maybe they'll make a lot less money. But they still have these houses and all that. What happens now? They say, wait, I need to put this on the market since it's so valuable and I'm just going to cash out, kind of thing?
Well, when you lose your job and you own a property that's, you know, $1 million middle class property that's, I mean, you can't. The median home price is like $2 million or something. I mean, you're not getting much. And if you lose your job and there's no other jobs, you have to sell and you have to sell and hope that someone's going to come in and buy that. And so who would? You know, fortunately, up till now, foreign investors would. And so that's really propped the market in San Francisco, New York, Seattle, Miami, probably a lot of foreign investors there, and parts of Florida, and certainly LA, Orange County. Orange County, I think like 60% of all new homes were sold full price to foreigners. So, you know, if they keep that up, then there'll be somebody who doesn't really need a local job. They're just trying to seek safety, getting their money out of wherever it's been. If it's in China, you know, they fear every day that something will happen and the government will change policy and their money's no longer there. So they try to get it out. But China's cracking down. They have a law that only allows $50,000 to exit the country every year, but nobody's really followed that. But
yeah, I've heard they've been using credit cards, this really weird credit card transactions.
Yeah.
And like lots of them, because you only can do a certain amount there too. That's also limited. But they're doing this weird thing where they're doing this multiple credit card transactions. There's probably companies built around that that will help. But yeah, no, China over on the west coast of the U.S. clearly is a big one. Also in New York, down here in Florida, also in Texas, there's a lot of influx from Latin America, Central America, South America, overall. And, you know, that's obviously something very big. But one of the big things happened is also that, and I wonder if this has something to do with it, that isn't there a bit of a sea change in the whole concept of big home ownership? I'm not talking about a little, you know, condo or an apartment or, I mean, from what I understand, the millennials, the next generations have been like, you know what, we want to live a little bit closer to the happening area. This whole suburb thing is interesting. you know, if I have kids and all that, maybe the schools, maybe the, you know, playground, maybe the backyard, maybe the pool. Okay, great. But a lot of them are waiting longer to have kids. They are saying, you know, they want to live closer to the metropolitan area, and they're willing to be more in smaller quarters, if you will. Now, that may be expensive, but still smaller quarters. Is that at all playing into this change of how what you're seeing out there more recently?
It will probably be the case for the next 10 years because the millennials are getting married later and having babies later. And the largest group of millennials are aged 22 to 24. So they're not going to be ready to settle down and have families for 10 years. Meanwhile, the second largest generation, baby boomers, are now second to millennials in size. You know, we're downsizing. We don't want these big houses anymore. And so, you know, what's interesting is that builders are still building the big houses because that's where they can make the profit. But new home sales were way down as a result. You know, people just, there's not the demand. So, you know, I couldn't agree more. But I think eventually the millennials, I could see the baby boomers wanting to move into town and wanting to have a hip life. They're done with their raising their kids and want to be walking distance from everything. But I think eventually the millennials are going to want the suburbs when they do start having families. But again, that's probably 10 years down the road. So that's why a lot of what we're doing is helping investors figure out what is the best investment, knowing that there's going to be a huge housing boom in about 10 years.
Right.
But right now there's a huge rental boom. And so being a landlord's a pretty hot ticket right now.
That's interesting that you mentioned the whole landlord thing. So I can only look at places that I've been. Now, first of all, I'll tell you about China. I don't know if you've been to China. They're building. They have built. They have these ghost cities that you hear about. I mentioned this to my listeners before. Have you ever seen these like up and close and personal?
I've only seen them, you know, in pictures. Have you actually been there?
Yeah, I've seen them.
Oh my gosh.
Can I tell you something? pictures do not do it justice.
Wow.
It
so
is,
it's real.
It is far more intense than you could ever imagine. You know, if you think about apartment complexes that you have built maybe in California, Miami, in New York, and wherever, pick whatever you want. You know, they have, what, 3 or 4 buildings maybe. You know, they're, I don't know, 25 stories tall maybe. You know, kind of those little apartment areas. You know what I'm talking about, right? In China, they're like these gigantic settlements. They're tall as can be, maybe 25, 30 stories, but tons of these big, ugly, like kind of light brown colored building, brick things. Gigantic and lots of them. They're almost like mountain ranges. They're like man-made. If you were in space, you'd probably think they were man-made mountain ranges, okay? And they're empty and they're enormous and they just keep going. I was on a road for 50 miles driving the whole time. I'll say 90% of the time. There was constant, right off the road, buildings that were totally empty, partially done, some of them done, but clearly nobody living in any of them. And they go back too. They're not just like right on the road, like a couple here. They're thick. They go way back. Wow. It's unbelievable to see. And I get that, you know, to just, you know, the whole Keynesian thing of saying, oh, let's just build to build and that will be good for the environment, you know, the economy and all that. But I'm seeing that here too, to a lesser degree, different. Not the same issue with vacancies, of course, but now we're starting to see like, wow, who's coming here? Who's going to live in all these things? And does anybody pay attention to traffic patterns? Because after a while, this is going to be a mess.
Yeah, it's bizarre. And I don't know what the thinking was there, but you know, it's, if you're trying to keep your investment dollars in the country, then I guess you just keep building stuff and that stimulates job growth until you got to figure out what to do with them.
Right, exactly. I'll tell you what you do. No, I'll tell you the answer. I have the answer.
Okay.
Now you just start, the new job is destruction of buildings.
Oh, God.
Seriously, I'm not kidding. Now you just do the reverse. You just do whatever you did in reverse.
Waste. That's so sad.
Yeah, and then you just kind of like, you know, maybe pound it all down and reestablish the brick and maybe take the glass and recycle it and make it again. And then you have, so instead of the people bringing the truckloads of stuff to the site, they just take it away. And instead of a crane going up, you have a wrecking ball. Seriously. I mean, that's what they're going to do. That's the insanity of this whole thing. Anyway, let's move on from that. So you see some problems and a little bit of a breakdown in the whole area of technology related buying, which maybe was popping up and propping up housing prices. And then if that didn't work, it was then the foreigners coming in. Now, let's talk about this whole foreign issue. Mm-hmm. Now, recently, there was some new legislation passed that there was this concept that foreigners were coming in and anonymously buying properties, whether, I guess, for investment properties, with various shell corporations and trusts they were using in order to buy these. Now, one of the things they did this was because there was a tax they had to pay?
Well, I think it's two separate things that, you know, a lot of people accuse this current administration of wanting to spy a lot on us. And so some people think that these new laws might be just a way for them to do more of that. But, you know, basically cities like New York City and Miami that's had a lot of kind of anonymous foreign buyers buying real estate, really high-end real estate. The cities have cracked down and said, we think this is drug money and that's why we're cracking down. But as a real estate investor, that's been, you know, one of the things that our claim to fame basically is that we want to be anonymous when we own investment property because we don't want someone to slip on our property and sue us. And so, you know, it really is a little scary, honestly. It could be the beginning of losing your anonymity as an investor. But, you know, again, the government's saying they're just trying to crack down on drug money.
Yeah, I mean, nobody seems to want privacy anyway. Just look at Facebook, for goodness sakes. Everybody disgorges everything that's going on there, and they're paying for their drugs through Venmo. So what's the difference?
That's true. But then the other thing that was just passed recently, which is really bizarre, and I'm guessing it's a sign. It tells me that the government's a little bit worried about the coming recession. And, you know, we're due for one. People shouldn't freak out too much. It's normal part of the cycle. You have to have recessions. There's one coming. But what the government just did in December, I believe, like the last day of Congress, they always sneak this stuff in, was removed this foreign tax, that tax on trust. So foreign pension funds had to pay an enormous tax when buying U.S. real estate. And that was changed. And so now there's billions of dollars of foreign pension funds that are buying up, not single family, not residential, but they're buying up big, famous commercial buildings in the U.S., you know, the Rockefeller Center type stuff. The stuff that the Japanese were doing in the 80s. And we're just
seeing it. And that didn't work out so well, by the way.
No, I mean, so much of this money that's coming in is from quantitative easing, you know, and all these different countries have done the same thing we've done. So it's just a big bubble. And then all that foreign money pouring in that's seeking safety, and they find it in the U.S., is driving prices up artificially. And anytime you have stimulus in real estate, you're going to see bubbles form. So obviously, you know, last decade, it was liar loans that created stimulus, and the market collapsed after. But now the stimulus is these foreign buyers and also, like I said, the venture capital money. So I am actively and aggressively encouraging people to sell as quickly as they can out of the bubble markets and exchange tax deferred through a 1031 exchange into non-bubble markets, because they exist. There's real estate markets in the U.S. that haven't even begun their boom. So you can really play the cycle and sell high and buy low, cash flow until those values go up.
So what's going to happen? I mean, are you talking about single families? Are you talking about multifamily? What are you talking about?
I'm mostly talking about single family because there's still a lot of distressed property out there in certain markets, mainly the judicial states. Florida being one of them. I mean, obviously not South Florida. That area has already recovered, but Central and Jacksonville, some of these areas haven't, you know, totally recovered yet. So still a wonderful opportunity to buy and cash flow. We've got unbelievable teams in those areas that find rental properties all ready to go, fixed up like new, with renters in them that members of our network can buy and rent for like half of what those properties cost in 2006.
I can attest to this, by the way. let's just say I have a friend that was convinced to buy a rental property. Let me back up. I have a friend that was going to buy a secondary vacation property in the central part of Florida. Mm-hmm. And it's on a lake. It's beautiful. And a 5-bedroom, big white sand beach, and on a lake, and boathouse, and deck, and jacuzzi, and all this good stuff. 5-bedroom, 3-bath. And put some money into it, straightened it up, made it look good. And then fast forward, that was in 2004 or so. Fast forward, it's worth the same amount today. Now, that went through a big dip and then back up. But compare that to, let's say, South Florida. That same, if let's just use a number, $500,000 for a house. Okay, same house, same concept of $500,000 on either one of those. Which now the lake house is worth $500,000, where the South Florida property was worth $500,000. That's probably worth $800,000 today.
Wow.
So there's like, you know, what's going on there. Now, mind you, just a little note for our listeners here. This lake house turned out to be a really great place to apply a rental deal, where there's a lot of different ways to skin the cat, right? So you have people renting it on a short-term or long-term basis, but short-term rentals are awfully profitable. A lot more work, but very profitable, especially if there's a season for it, you know, and you have certain seasons for those depending on where it is and where it's located. Like, obviously, there's a season for houses in Colorado. You know, obviously during ski season, you'll get a lot more money for a particular property. And there's various places, like you maybe manage some of these. And there's even if people want to do their own management, you know, a VRBO or Airbnb or whatever it may be. Is that at all also helping the real estate market for investment properties like these VRBOs, HomeAways, Airbnb, and things of that nature? Is that kind of helping the real estate market from a rental standpoint?
It's hurting renters because it is so much more profitable to short-term lease that it's causing rents to go up. So again, like it's just the perfect storm to be a landlord and to be in, you know, collecting cash flow on rental property, whether it's long-term or short-term, because, you know, there's some cities who are actually banning Airbnb and VRBO. So I'd be really careful about buying a property just for that purpose because certain cities have so much short-term rentals that they don't have long-term rentals, and people have no place to live. So,
well, I think also the the very strong lobby of hotel, motel is also a big part of that. They don't like these either.
They don't like it. Yeah. They're lobbying
well,
against it.
You know, if you think about it, look what happened with, for example, look at Uber, right? So Uber, is there really any difference between an Uber and a taxi? Okay, well, maybe there's some cost factors. Maybe getting the taxi in certain areas. I mean, if you're in New York City, just put your hand up and get a taxi, for goodness sakes, right? But in other places where it's not as easy to get a taxi, you make a call 25 minutes later. Do they come? Do they not come? Who is it? You get in the taxi. It's a little bit more expensive. Uber, you click a button, 5 minutes, they're there. It's easy. It's done. But that really killed the whole rental car business around the country and maybe even around the world. It's, I mean, the rental car companies are hurting terribly. And you see their stocks. Their stocks are not looking very good.
Wow.
I mean, really bad. It's interesting of whether or not there is the potential for the Airbnbs, VRBOs, vacation by owner, you know, all those, if that is going to have the same effect, if it becomes so much more easy than it would for if it's going to be with the hotels. Now, there's a big difference, right? A hotel, there's someone there that you say, hello, send up a club sandwich. You know what I'm saying? Right. Hi, I need 3 more towels, please. Or, yeah. You know, whatever it is. It's you know, you get up in the morning, you leave, you come back, your whole house is all, you know, it's all made. In a house that you're renting is a little bit different, right? There's not mm-hmm. that going on. There could be other issues that happen, et cetera. So all I'm saying is there's definitely a difference, whereas it was so clear cut, easier, cleaner, and more efficient to work with Uber than it is to obviously rent a house. Although when you rent an apartment or house, it's probably much nicer. You got much more potential privacy.
It's better for families.
Yeah,
for
yeah,
sure.
It's definitely a lot more people you can put in there, et cetera. You know, you don't have to have 2 beds and, you know, mm-hmm. God knows what's going on next door to you, if you know what I'm saying, in the hotel. So it's interesting, though, that if I just take this full circle and kind of summarize what we've talked about here for a second, is that you're involved and involved in both sides of the real estate. And it's kind of interesting to find that you're bullish and bearish at the same time, right? So you're bearish on what has been working and what has been really doing really well. And you're saying that, you know what, it's time, and I think you even said it's time, get out. It's time to sell. Put it up for sale. Yeah. Let's get out quickly. I don't know how much longer these kind of great prices are going to last, at least in this cycle. There may be a recession. We don't know. But there's a lot of things that you're sniffing out that is not good for the high-end, high-tech bubble type, or I should say the booming areas. And now you're saying rotate into areas that are still distressed. Now, how come those areas won't see more problems if there is a recession or if there is a further slowdown?
Well, it's a great question. And basically, the research I've done shows that we've got an overvalued stock market that's going to adjust. Those who are invested in the stock market are going to feel the pain. And so that's why the high-priced cities like New York City, San Francisco, LA, and possibly Miami and parts of Chicago, anywhere where there's been large investment in the stock market, when those people lose their money, they're not buying vacation homes. They're not, they're going to feel the pain. Whereas if you're buying in a place like in Ohio or, you know, where there's factory type jobs that aren't going anywhere, but it's the heart of America, the production, the very limited production that we do, that doesn't just stop because of a stock market crash. And so it's really the blue collar towns that are going to survive the recession much better. And those people will likely not lose their jobs. And so, you know, owning little tiny blue collar working class homes is in my opinion, the safest place for your money today.
Let me just interrupt for a second. So the difference is it would be like 5 years ago buying into Detroit.
Well, Detroit has its own problems.
Well, clearly.
Where they're not, they have not been worker friendly, or I should say employment friendly. So the biggest problem with Detroit is they drove business out. And so it's just job losses, which resulted in a lot of people on the street, which resulted in crime. And I mean, gosh, you could go to Detroit and get a handful of houses for free. They just want to give them away. They pay you to take them. So Detroit's its own animal, and it's really a problem of a union problem. What we did in the last, see, we're sitting here exactly where we sat 10 years ago in 2006. It's identical. And yet somehow people don't remember.
Yeah, well. That's easy to forget, right? It's just,
yeah,
everything got back and better and what, you know, a few things here and there. I mean, the people that remember are the people that were hurt.
They're not remembering though. Even though the people that got hurt, it's like back in 2006, we were dramatically, emphatically telling people to sell, or like it doesn't make sense. People can't afford a house here in California. Sell, but there was a part of the country that was doing the opposite, and at the time it was Texas, and Texas was doing the opposite of California. It was attracting business. It was offering tax incentives. And guess what? It became the most productive part of the U.S. with the highest job growth and the highest population growth. Because guess what? Businesses go where they're welcome. And so what happened at the time is in 2006, when California was 100% overvalued, Texas was 28% undervalued in the housing market. So we told people, sell at your high-priced California property and exchange it for these brand new homes next to new jobs, next to Headquarter Row. You could exchange by $100,000 brand new home that rents for the same house, same as your $400,000 California teardown, you know? Mm-hmm. And so the thing about the U.S. is it's not one market cycle. It's just hundreds, if not thousands, of different market cycles. So if you can learn what to see in a cycle and get out in time and not get in, I mean, 80% of the population still jumps in at the end, right before the bubble bursts, every time.
Yep. Well, this has been quite fascinating. There's a lot of things going on, a little bit of a warning on real estate, but yet a little bit of a silver lining on the other side, obviously, the whole point is it's classic stock market rotation thesis. You know, it's like, let's look for what's overvalued. Let's sell that. Let's buy what's undervalued. Let's go in there. You're like a value investor for real estate.
I am. And I can't stand to see people make mistakes and lose their money and then give real estate a bad name. It's like, you just have to learn that, you know, cycles repeat. And you know, there's ways to profit. Right now, people can secure their wealth and enjoy cash flow, double their equity over the next few years, and other people are going to lose everything. And so the more I can get on shows like yours and warn people not to get comfortable and not to believe the headline news, but to really dive in deeper. I share tons of that on my blog and my own podcast. I'm constantly trying to alert people to not keep doing the same thing.
I hear you. I mean, no, listen, we do the same thing over and over. And like you know, I think the big thing, and I think we can end on this, the whole point is that what I think people miss, and by the way, it's very easy to miss this because we're humans, we have emotions, and, you know, we want to be optimistic. We want to see better things in the future. There's no question about that. There's nothing wrong with that, by the way. Mm-hmm. But the thing is that, you know, as you mentioned, that there is a natural cycle that is from trough to peak in an economic cycle. While the central banks have tried to make us believe that they can control this and not cause any excess on either side, or make it too hot or too cold, if you will, the temperature could just stay perfectly level forever. And that, you know, the more, even though you have, don't worry, if it goes down a little bit, we'll be there to support it. If it goes up a little bit, we'll slow it down so it doesn't overheat. The problem is we're not an island alone either. Just the very nature of international investors coming into the market throws the whole thing out of whack.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Exactly. I mean, so the thing is, we are cycles. And, you know, again, I have a different take on it. If you own your own home, you're living in your home, you like where you're living and all that, okay, what are you going to do? You're not just moving for an investment. That's a different thing. We're talking about investment properties to the degree, and, you know, kind of looking at that versus, you know, the place that you're going to live and spend the rest of your life. And if you love where you live and all that, doesn't matter what the value is, really. I mean, come on, who cares? I mean, if you love your house, it doesn't matter. All right. Well, great stuff. Kathy Fetke, we're going to put all the information on how to get in touch with you and listen to your podcast and read your blogs and find out more information about where those good investment properties are and all of that on the show notes for this episode of The Disciplined Investor. You'll come back on soon, and we're gonna keep a watch on all these different areas. I appreciate you you sharing your wisdom.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, we'll talk soon. Thanks so much again. That was Kathy Fetke. Again, all the information about Kathy and the Real Wealth Network can be found on the DisciplinedInvestor.com website under the show notes for this episode, episode number 461. Wow, 461 episodes. I mean, if you think about that, just divide that. Kind of missed a week here or there over the time. But what is that? That's, divide that over, let me get my calculator here. Divide that over, let's say that we do, 50 a year? approximately 50 different episodes a year. So we take, let's see, clear that, and we got 461 divided by 50. We're talking about 9 years. It's going on 9 years. Well, that's pretty cool. That makes sense. Yeah, 2007. Yeah, we started this back then, and it's been growing ever since. Make sure to tell your friends, your relatives, the people you like. Tweet it, Facebook it, instant message it, FaceTime it, Periscope it. Do whatever you're going to do. But make sure to do me a favor and tell people about the Disciplined Investor podcast if you like it. Because the more people that listen and have the access to this kind of information, which is an unbiased, at least I think it's an unbiased look at markets, bringing some of the best guests in the industry to bring the straight information to you on a weekly basis. I mean, how much better does it get than that, right? How much better does it get than that? Thank you for listening. Thank you for telling your friends about it. Thank you for putting us at the top of the business podcast area when it comes to this interesting type of topic. Before we got to Kathy, I had mentioned, I think I'm going to talk, by the way, on DH Unplugged about my new phone. I got the iPhone 6S Plus, the big one, kind of the bells and whistles. I'll talk about what happened to my phone last week as well. But before we got to Kathy, I was talking about a variety of things. I was talking about some things regarding Apple. I was talking about Japan. And in particular, I was talking about what was going on in Japan, the fact that Kuroda, who is the equivalent of Janet Yellen, who actually I have always thought has a kind of a radio program that's probably on throughout the trading day where he can kind of talk and say things and move markets the way that he wants to. Somehow, I don't know if he had a lapse of judgment. I don't know if he had just an inability to do so, but did not by any means make the markets happy last week. Now, Japan is very, very reliant on the value of the yen, the weakening yen to help their exports, and the yen and the Nikkei are very correlated. When you see the yen weakening, you see the Nikkei go up in value. You see the yen strengthening, you see the Nikkei go down in value. Well, this shock to the system where Kuroda, who there was expectations of him just, again, throwing in everything this time around to break the chain of lousy GDP and lousy inflation, didn't happen. And man, the currency trade got whipsawed around and reversed, and the markets got just sold off like crazy. As a matter of fact, the DXJ, which is something we hold short, I think I've talked about many times how much I don't like the Japanese market from a valuation standpoint, or really from a structural standpoint. And as a matter of fact, I think I even said that, I think it was last week, I talked about how, you know, why not invest in the Japanese market if the government's just going to constantly buy in? I mean, we talked about how they own 50% of the ETFs, and they own 10% or more of many of the major stocks, if not all the major stocks in the Nikkei. I said, well, why not just invest in there? But I was obviously not serious about that. But that's what most investors were thinking. Just invest along. Meanwhile, if you look at the DXJ, which again was short, it was down 7.9% after this announcement. And then another 2% the next day. I mean, talk about like 8 or 9% drop in 2 days on the Nikkei. We'll see where this opens up this week and how this plays out, because the yen kept on moving and the Japanese markets were actually closed for a holiday. But there's some real problems there. I don't know what's going to happen now. Does Kuroda come in and do his usual surprise and try to, just totally throw the markets off? Maybe come in with some additional stimulus now because they didn't like what happened with markets. Because don't forget, these central banks, they're talking about, they're all about working on different kinds of measures to prop up the economy. But in the end, they're really all about markets. I mean, especially in Japan, there's no secret here. If they're buying into ETFs in the market and they're directly investing into individual equities or whatever they're doing in the markets, they're obviously very, very much concerned about market issues. So, with that in mind, you have to realize that this is a big blow to what's gone on there. Now, I thought that it was also interesting that China came out with some numbers, and while it was still above 50 on the manufacturing, it was a little bit slower than last month. So while you're seeing headlines right now that are saying that, well, China continues an expansion and things are getting better and market just economy stabilizing and bottoming out here, fact is, It's still, while over 50 and in an expansionary mode in the last month or two, the fact is it did come a little bit weaker than we did see, historically, and we do see that in their GDP numbers. Now, I was thinking about GDP here, so I went to the tradingeconomics.com site. If you haven't checked this out, by the way, great website for information, particularly about economics around the world. You can actually follow them on Twitter as well. They don't advertise, but I'm giving them a big plug here because they are a terrific site with charts and information and outlook and all sorts of great stuff. Tradingeconomics.com. If you look at the GDP annual growth of countries and various areas around the world, listen to these numbers. The United States now, we just talked about how we are at a 2% annualized. The lowest ever was back in the times back in 2007-08, which was down about 4.1%. The highest was 13% back in the 50s and 60s time period. But let me tell you some of these numbers and just show you how things are playing out. Euro area is at 1.6%, Japan 1.7%, Germany 1.7%, UK 2.1%, France 1.4%, Brazil 4.5% to the negative side, Italy 0.8%. These are numbers that are just moderately blah. There's nothing really good about any of these numbers to speak of. And as a matter of fact, if you look at this GDP annual growth rate and look at the lowest in history and the highest in history, we are on the low end, not the lowest, because a lot of these were in the severe negatives during various recession / depression eras in the past. But we are really showing no growth around the world. So the only thing that we really have to go for a positive note on this is the fact that we have excessive amounts of stimulus that's being provided by many, if not all, the governments around the world in one way or another, and financial engineering. And this is just a theme we've been talking about and talking about and talking about. And then you have to wonder, well, where is this going to play out? When is this going to end? Well, we did see what happened when the United States started saying, well, we're going to raise rates. Markets were not happy. Things turned around. When you have the currency start to move up like it did, we saw oil plummet. We saw commodities plummet. And then when we did see that this year to date, the dollar is down about 5.5%, what's happening? Gold has shot up. We see a major recovery in oil. We see that there is the, again, the spirits of people looking to be bullish on markets. So a lot of changes there. Now, contrast that to what just happened in Japan when they're saying there's not going to be any more stimulus. And the markets dropped almost, you know, we'll see how the futures play out, but potentially 9% in 2 or 3 days on that. Pulling away that candy bowl really pissed off investors, because a lot of this that has been going on is predicated on the fact that we have very cheap money and it's all about these buybacks and financial engineering. And again, I don't want to keep on pounding that, but pounded enough that we are all very aware of what's going on. And that's how we're seeing markets move from the trading standpoint of getting overdone, like we are probably right now on the S&P 500, at least in the near term. Will we see another top and all? Will the Fed come out with some good numbers? Will the employment numbers this week be just amazing? We see a turnaround and a basing and a move back for manufacturing, with the fact that the dollar has come back a bit and dropped down, possibly. But man, you got to find out what's going on with the rest of the world these days, and if they're going to continue to see these kind of hiccups when it comes to central bank moves, you know, where they're in experimental negative territory already. This is something that's going to be very much wearing on investor confidence and sentiment. So just a thought about that. I did mention that I was on Frank Curzio's show, I think it was last week or the week before. Some interesting things we talked about there. Of course, listen to DH Unplugged each and every week on Tuesdays. Myself, John C. Dvorak, talk about some very interesting and I think sometimes kind of funny business news that comes along. And we really get into deep detail about some of the other sides of the business that we're seeing and the news that we're seeing. So make sure to listen to that each and every week as well. If you have any questions, of course, you can write me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com as well. That's it for this show. A lot covered in a very short period of time. And I hope that you make sure to go back to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, check on the show notes so you can find out all the little things we talked about and how to get to the information about our guest today, Kathy Fetke from the Real Wealth Network. And other than that, have a great week. We'll see you around the corner.
Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.